Morning. Why would he do that? No, he said he got put him on the side. Why did he say this people boy? Responsible social media. Depending on what time you're starting. You are now the room. Oh, I needed to look at.
Start the recording. Good. All right. Thank you very much, Nigel. So good morning, everyone. I am Kamala Rampasada Silva, Chief Executive Officer of the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute. It is my pleasure this morning to welcome you to today's session, Procurement and the Changing Role of the Board. There's a governance response that is required if companies are to properly fulfill their role under the new procurement legislation. There will definitely be new rules for procurement officers and also new policies that must be put in place for organizations. Directors too must be aware of what are the changes that should be addressed in boardroom discussions. This fits within their transparency and accountability duties as directors. Just before I hand over to the panel, I just want to remind persons of our housekeeping announcements, which is we would really appreciate if you will keep your microphone on mute. And when we move to the question and answer segment, if you can raise your hand using the icon at the bottom of your screen. Today's panel is led by the illustrious Afra Raymond. Mr. Raymond has been at the forefront of this fight to ensure that regulations are passed so that there can be an improvement in our procurement practices here in Trinidad and Tobago. Afra is a professional fellow of the RICS and the managing director of Raymond & Peel Limited. He also contributes to the press and broadcast media in Trinidad and Tobago and the Caribbean. His special areas of interest include real estate, property development, land use planning, property taxation, property financing, and the 2009 bailout of the CL Financial Group. He will offer the feature presentation this morning before engaging discussions with the panel. So our panel will also comprise of Mr. Munilal Lalchan, who is the chairman and procurement regulator of the Procurement Board of Trinidad and Tobago. We are very happy to have him join us for today's session. Mr. Lalchan has served on the Board of Governance and was also chairman of the Audit Committee of the National Energy Skills Center, as well as chairman of the Board of Directors of Invest TNT Limited and the Educational Facilities Company Limited. Our other panelist on the board is Executive Chairman of CLECO, Mrs. Claire Gomez-Miller. She brings a wealth of experience as a certified internal auditor and a certified risk manager, management assurance professional. She has over 30 years of auditing experience in the energy and state sectors. At present, Claire serves on the board of Unipet, Alutech, and Lake Asphalt. So the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute has brought together this panel to discuss the role and function of the board if we are to achieve the changes that we want to see with access to our public purse. I will now hand you over to our panel moderator for this morning, who is the chairman of the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute, Mr. Nigel Romano.
Thank you, Kamala. As we all know, the procurement legislation is imminent. It primarily affects public companies, companies that are owned or in which the government has an interest. And we thought that this session would help directors, both in the public sector and in the private sector, to have a better appreciation for what the procurement legislation means. And I know Mr. Lanchal has been doing yeoman service going around and educating boards of various companies across the sector. So I'm looking forward to a very interesting and very informative conversation this morning. And I am very happy that Afra has decided to join us to give us his years of experience, his perspective, and his passion. So without further ado, let's hear from Afra. I will shut up now and Afra, take it.
Nigel, it's always pleasurable to be introduced by you and welcome this morning to colleagues to the seminar. Are you hearing me okay?
Definitely.
Good. I'm having a little problem where I'm not hearing myself in the earphones, but it's fine. Let's start. So The thing we want to get at in this morning's seminar, what I get from having had exchanges with Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute, and I thank you for the opportunity to participate in this important seminar. I've had a long, fruitful association with the organization in all its various incarnations. Now we have the Romano era, so I'm looking forward to working again with the Romano era. The corporate governance importance can't be overstated, because the way we organize ourselves in the current dispensation to do most of our important activities is in one form or the other, so through some kind of body, corporate, incorporated body. Whether it's the state, through the many state enterprises and public agencies and state agencies, or whether it's the private sector, and I know that there are colleagues from the private sector tuning into the session this morning. And the private sector, we normally form a company or a joint venture or some kind of incorporation process takes place. So these are very pertinent considerations as we look at the procurement law being the new architecture to govern how we deal when we are transacting with public money or disposing of public property. Now, I'm not going to focus in this discussion on the bits and pieces of the Procurement Act. From time to time, I will do so. My focus is really going to be on what I would say is the hitherto unexamined territory that CCGI is trying to examine this morning. In other words, what is the overlap or the interface between the responsibilities of a properly managed board of directors and the new form of laws, the procurement laws that are coming into force under the leadership of the Office of Procurement Regulation, Mr. Lal Chan. And those laws are important. And I'm just going to give a little 60-second statement here at the beginning. They're important because progress is not only necessary, but it's possible. We actually can make progress. And it's actually important for us to make progress and recognize that things have not been as they should have been in the past. If anything, although we have a pause at the moment because of COVID-19, I want to tell myself it's a pause. If anything, that would make us realize that it is more important than ever where there are limited resources and there are tremendous responsibilities, that those resources, whether they are beds in hospitals or oxygen or bandages or face masks, that those resources be distributed in accordance with needs and in accordance with fair play and in accordance with equity. And it shouldn't be a question of zigzag dealings. Those issues of procurement that in the past might have seemed to be merely financial issues or political point scoring are going to assume greater and greater importance as this healthcare crisis and this public policy crisis unfolds around the globe. We're going to see the stories, okay? So the public procurement discourse is very pertinent. And in terms of its interface with corporate governance, how we organize ourselves to do what we are about, which is a kind of cultural question, okay? Now, of course, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And one has to be aware that transparency and the visibility of what's happening is very, very important. And we have seen a sort of a line being thread in all of those press conferences about COVID. So every day there's a press conference now, but still there are things that they won't say and they can't say. And it's important to preserve some kind of privacy for people's rights. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the public and private faces of this question. We're dealing with the question of the responsibilities of the board under the Companies Act of 95 and also within the umbrella of the procurement law. And my first reading of it, when I got the first email from Mrs. Ramprasad De Silva, my first reading of it was that was really a seminar aimed at directors of state enterprises. That was what I thought. And when I reflected on it, I thought to myself, no, it can't just be that. It has to be more. And it is more because there's the first question is that there are large private companies that have frequent dealings with the state. Companies that nobody would dream of saying that is a public company. but they have frequent dealings. And in fact, I would say probably 70% of the economic activity of the country, in one way, shape, or form, is somebody having dealings in the state in terms of the actual business in the country. So we need to be aware that if we go to the definition of what public money is, because public money is defined in the act, and public money is defined in the preamble to the act, and the Public Procurement and Disposal of Public Property Act, the architecture over the whole thing is designed to put in place measures to control transactions in public money. Therefore, the definition of public money is absolutely important. And one of the first ones, exactly given out in six parts. One of the first ones is that it relates to money that's received or receivable by a public body. So obviously, if a public body is paying out, is receiving taxes, that is public money. Or license fees, that is public money. But also, interestingly enough, we have a question where we talk about money being raised by an instrument from which it can reasonably be inferred that the state accepts ultimate liability in the case of a default. What does that mean? It's a bit of a mouthful. What does it mean? I see we have a banker here with us, Nigel. What it means to me, as one of the people who was in the room when we were putting together this, because we are the ones who put it together in a civil society collaboration, what it meant to us and what it meant to me being in the room is that things that we unquestioningly accept as being, the government is doing this or the government is doing that, but we don't see them as acts of procurement, fall within this. And I'll give you some examples. If a government agency were to try to, if a state agency were to try to raise money via issuing a bond, for example, for housing, or WASA issuing a bond, or TTMF issuing a bond to create more mortgages to buy HDC houses. Those are all operations where, in fact, the money is raised by an instrument, which is the bond issue, from which it could be reasonably inferred that in the event of a default, the state would step in. Because if WASA were unable to pay its bond for whatever reason, or TTMF were unable to pay its bond for whatever reason, the state would be bound to step in to prevent what is tantamount to a state default, because that has an impact on the country's credit rating. The point I'm getting at is that there may be elements, some of you may be tuned to this discussion, there may be elements from the financial world, accountants, people working in the finance services companies that actually facilitate government in putting together these bonds, merchant banks and corporate bankers and so on, who may think their procurement law has nothing to do with them. They may think procurement is to do with contracts and things and bridges and roads and EFCL and HDC and that kind of thing. But in fact, procurement has everything to do with you. Once you are transacting in public money, it is to do with you. And which is what brings us to the center of the discussion now. What is the proper role of the board of directors in relation to that set of responsibilities? The Companies Act 1995, I think it was on a Canadian model, it's 25 years old now. It was on a Canadian model. And that act is really kind of interesting, particularly the part where they talk about the company's directors' responsibilities. Because Section 99, subsection 1 of the act, to me is the kernel, the kernel of the whole thing, where in fact they talk about the fact of the directors having a responsibility and a duty to deal with the strategy and the direction of the company. And really, at all times, the only entity the director is supposed to serve is the company. Their directors don't have regard for anything else, the company. So the company is actually concretized in the act as an entity that deserves the full care and attention, not first priority, not best efforts, but full care and attention of the board of directors. And the company's exposure, in the case of private companies, the company's exposure under the Public Procurement and Disposal of Public Property Act is such that, in fact, one ought to be aware that the company's directors operate in a manner they need to be show of operating in a manner that does not unduly expose the company or jeopardize the company under the terms of the procurement law. Because the terms of the procurement law can be extremely onerous, even in the case of a private company that isn't a state enterprise or a politically appointed board of directors. And the it is therefore incumbent on the company directors in a private company to put policies and procedures and strategies in place. In other words, to use the MBA language, risk management, to identify those risks and manage them responsibly within the ambit of 99.1. So that in fact, one conforms with procurement law, which is now a very powerful law coming into force, okay? With respect, I'll continue with private companies for a while. So I identified with an example, which is from the preamble, public money, subsection B. I identified with an example how transactions that we may not have considered to be acts of procurement, as far as I am concerned, they very well are. I could even go further, and let's discuss something that was a little controversial recently, and not in an effort to stoke controversy, but to stoke consideration. So we had some issues with the FCB IPO, and I'm not going to get into what those issues were. I'm making a point. A state enterprise, which makes a decision, no doubt at the cabinet level, to dispose of part of those assets in the form of a disposal of shares, like FCB was selling about 20% of itself in the IPO. Under the old scenario, a certain set of things happened, and it's not my purpose now to go into what those things are. But I make the point that a future IPO of a state enterprise, even a partial IPO, in my respectful view, could be considered to be a disposal of public property. Because if state enterprise X, which is profitable and doing nicely, thank you very much, decides to sell 15% of itself on the directions of the cabinet for some sort of budget support and to raise capital and so on in a period of deficit budgeting, that's all too likely. If state enterprise X has to sell 10 or 15% of itself on the stock market, that operation, that financial market operation, in my respectful view, is a disposal of public property, because the shares in state enterprise X is a form of public property. Some people think about the phrase public property literally as referring only to property like land and buildings and the land at Invaders Bay and that kind of thing, and the Karani land and so on. Public property, in fact, it's interesting. If you go down in the preamble, again, same with the preamble of the act, which is packed with meaning, it actually tells us that public property means real or personal property owned by a public body. Now, real property, we can all understand that. Real property means real estate. Okay. Personal property is a term in legal use. And what personal property means is any other property that's not real estate. It doesn't mean personal thing like your watch and your tie and your shoe on your foot. It means anything that's not real estate, in law, they just call that personal property. So for example, the shares in a company is personal property. For example, the airwaves, the Telecommunications Authority of Trinidad and Tobago, license and allocate and allow Company Y to run 2 TV stations and 4 radio stations. That is proper. That is personal property too, in the ownership of a public body, the control of a public body. Yes. So there's a broad series of meanings to property that go way beyond the 2-acre block of land belonging to the state enterprise or the 70 something acres at Invaders Bay. The point being that future IPO issues and a lot of financial market operations, and I know Claire Gomez Miller, you are with us. We're looking forward to having a nice exchange with you on these questions. And Nigel, you are from that same universe too. So it's going to be interesting. But I am putting the point squarely for consideration that the financial universe And the private sector part of this financial universe certainly is, as far as I'm concerned, in the center of this series of laws. It has not formed the discussion so far. Okay? It has not formed the discussion so far because the discussion so far has really been about construction contracts and Unicorp and the highway to Point 14 and a whole lot of things like that. And I am part of that too. I certainly push those discussions. No denying that. Okay? But that's only a part of what this is about. The other thing I want to say, so that's the first thing. So the penalties, let's get clear and understand what the penalties are. The penalties under the procurement law for a private company that was found to have breached the provisions of the act as far as conforming with the laws on procurement, the penalties for a private company could include the procurement regulator has the power to do something called a cross disbarment for up to 10 years. Now, let's talk a little bit about what's a cross disbarment. It's one of those sticky legal phrases. At the moment in Trinidad and Tobago, we operate in what is called silos. And what that means is that I think that the last time we checked, there were maybe over 200 different bodies that have the power to transact public money in this country. In between ministries, state enterprises, statutory agencies, government agencies, NGOs that spend public money, it's over 200 bodies in this country that have the power to transact public money. And those bodies all operate with one version or the other with some sort of model of privacy. So they all have reasons why they wouldn't share information with the other person. And as a result, it's possible, going back to the whole example of contractors, it's possible for a contractor to do bad work. Let's just make an example. For Wasser, a contractor could do poor work for Wasser. Work that has to be rebuilt. Buildings that get cracked. The person could get caught offering a bribe. And all of that. And Wasser could do the good and proper thing and investigate contractor X and decide that they're not giving any more work to contractor X. It happens. There are professional people with good ethics working in our public sector and in our private, our state enterprise sector. And they could analyze the problem and make the correct decision and decide they're not giving any more work to contractor X. It happens. Okay. But what also happens is because we operate in silos, that same contractor X, who is way out of his rights within Wasser, could continue to get work from TNTech, the Digo Martin Regional Corporation, the Airport Authority, and the Tobago House of Assembly. Because there's no mechanism by which those different bodies would know what Wasser decided. You're relying on the contractor's integrity when they're filling out a form, a pre-qualification form. Have you ever been struck off? Of course he's going to say no. Have you ever been investigated? The answer to that is no as well. You're relying on the one person who has the highest motivation not to tell the truth is who you're relying on to fill out the form for pre-qualification. So the current procurement processes, because of the structure of silos, are fundamentally flawed because you're placing reliance on the person upon whom you could least place reliance. The new system coming forward is one in which that information will be pooled and you have a national database. So in fact, if Wasser gets to the point of making that decision, we're not using this person again, everybody becomes aware of it. The procurement regulator, as an office, they can also make a ruling that we're not using this person for 5 years. And that ruling will apply across all the state entities that deal with transactions in public money. So in fact, it has a higher impact. That is what a cross disbarment is. And the reason for me to spend this time on this point is that cross disbarments have a tremendous importance because a company that doesn't put proper procedures in place to protect itself and to stabilize itself could find itself on the wrong side of an investigation by the procurement regulator, because it's not everything that happens in a company that you know about. You could set up a company. I don't accept the idea that the people at the top always know exactly what's going on. You could set up a company. I mean, I run a company, yeah? So I could tell you it's true. You could set up a company with your values and your ethics. You put systems in place. And you create, I think, incentives. What do you call it? Incentivized pay. You create systems to incentivize your middle managers and your people in your divisions and so on. And those people could actually make up their own way to perform, to meet targets, and to beat the odds and so on. And unless you are very, very careful and you have procedures in place, you as a company, some of you listening to this morning's seminar, you as a company and having a board of directors that has not put proper procedures in place to vet for those things, the company could be exposed. Because when OPR makes a finding against company X, the finding is not against a person. They're not going to find the divisional manager, Tom Smith, was wrong, and we're not going to have dealings with Tom Smith. They will make a finding that company X was in breach of A, B, and C. And we are doing a cross disbarment against company X. And all of a sudden, the misdemeanors or the felonies of Tom Smith, who's a divisional manager, overambitious, have an impact across the whole company, because the company may not have had the proper procedures to identify the behavior of somebody like Tom Smith and deal with it before it became a fate, a fatality inside of the company. And for companies in Trinidad and Tobago, for those of you who are not here and don't appreciate some of what I might be hinting at, because of the size of the state in our economy, if you get across this barment, it is something very close to a death sentence, because you really would have had a huge amount of your work dried up. Very few companies are in a position that almost none of their work is from the state. Very few firms are in that position. So it's a matter of real importance for company directors to be cognizant of this and to put procedures in place to identify what are the projects we're going for. Projects to build water supply. What are the public-private partnerships we're getting involved in? On what basis? What is the business case? And to test proposals to see if they can pass the smell test before those proposals are allowed to leave and take part in the melee, and test those proposals before they come under the scrutiny of the Office of Procurement Regulator. I'll take a pause here and I'll make a point about the OPR. I'm going to take in front and clarify a point that sometimes still is a little ambiguous in some minds, which is the question of how does the OPR operate? Just let me restate it. The OPR does not issue award contracts or anything like that. OPR does not advertise, it's not the Central Tenders Board. The Central Tenders Board is a centralized system which acted as agent for the ministries and the various local authorities and some of the state agencies, statutory bodies and so on. Under the OPR system, the public procurement system we're discussing this morning, all of the state entities, the ministries, the local government bodies, the government agencies, all of those agencies that transact in public money retain their powers to do so. So the Ministry of Works or WASA or TNTech, they have the power to advertise and to seek tenders and to evaluate those tenders and to make an award. So in a kind of a way, because the Central Tenders Board is extinguished when the OPR is born in its full powers, a lot of those agencies that did not really have those departments before, those powers are going to be returned to them. So it's a kind of a derogation. You're actually giving them back their power, okay? What the OPR does is it performs an oversight function. So it's procurement regulation. And channels are opened up for whistleblowers. Channels are opened up for concerned persons. There's a fast tracking of investigations. There's a requirement with serious punishments for infractions. There's a requirement to supply information upon request when the procurement regulator requisitions information, there's a requirement to do that. And Office of Procurement Regulation manages complaints and blips in the procurement system, sort of like a management by exceptions approach to the thing. They create policies and they create procedures and they have guidelines and handbooks and rules and so on. But the state entities, they have their own powers to seek contracts and advertise and so on and assess those contracts and issue award the contracts. So the private companies have a serious responsibility to do, to make sure that they don't fall foul of the procurement rules. The public companies, that is my thing on the private companies so far. The public companies are where it becomes very, very interesting. The private one was quite interesting. The public ones are where it becomes very, very interesting. Because up until this moment, in our national affairs, we've had a situation in which public companies, by which I mean state enterprises and statutory bodies and so on, and I'm lumping them all together for now, and then I'll go to another point, I'll separate them to make another further point. So I've lumped together state and state-owned enterprises with statutory bodies. Those two sorts of public companies have been used to implement policies of the state. So in the case of TN Tech, it was a kind of an affordable and a safe power supply for the country's homes and businesses. So that was TN Tech satisfying a public policy mandate. WASA, there's other mandates, and PTSC, and you can go down the line and get the picture, okay? Some less effectively than others, but that's not the purpose of this morning's discourse. We're on a governance point. We're not really on delivery as such. We're on procedure and policy. Now, one of the big questions that comes about, and it's huge, one of the big questions that has rolled around for about 40 years is because the state enterprises as a creature are about 40 years old. They already came into their own in 1978 when there was an exception made in the Central Tenders Board Act to create, I guess, a special advantage for state enterprises, because state enterprises all of a sudden were exempted from the Central Tenders Board Act. So that led to the proliferation of central tenders of state enterprises that we have with us today. Because people wanted to be able to do what they wanted to be able to do without the oversight of the Central Tenders Board. And we could pause here and tip our hat to the Central Tenders Board. I don't often tip my hat. Not that I ever wear one, but I will tip my hat to the Central Tenders Board by saying that our conventional understanding of governance and best practice would tell us that the Central Tenders Board is not a very effective arrangement, because all the members of the Central Tenders Board are appointed by the Minister of Finance. That's the fact. The Central Tenders Board are appointed by the Finance Minister, whoever it is. They're still on Frederick Street. They still exist, opposite St. Mary's College. And interestingly enough, the Central Tenders Board, once they created the 1979 exemption, a whole series of state enterprises were born, all in an attempt to escape the scrutiny. Someone said it was the scrutiny of the Central Tenders Board. So at some level, the Central Tenders Board offered a degree of scrutiny that at some level, the political directorate found unwelcome. And I'll say something to those of you who may not know it. I like to stick these little bits in. If you go to the Ministry of Finance website now, everybody's online. Go to the Ministry of Finance website now. The Central Tenders Board is a division of the Ministry of Finance. And as far as the point I'm making about transparency, which is one of my bellwethers, the Central Tenders Board has actually got a very good model of transparency. Because if you go on there, you can actually see, I think they make a quarterly report of all the tenders that they've done. and that they have actually issued contracts for this and for that and to supply the other and to build this and to build that. And it's a reflection of two things. It's a reflection of constancy because they have actually maintained this quarterly report online for quite a long time. And I wish other state agencies could say the same, but it isn't, and we all know why. And it's also a record, not only of constancy, but a record of bureaucratic sidelining, because you can actually notice from the early part of those reports coming down to now, how the items that have been reported have diminished in importance, because more and more ways are found to take things out of the hands of the Central Tenders Board. So it raises a question about whether a ministerial appointment is necessarily the same thing as ineffective oversight, which takes us to the current arrangement with the current public bodies. So we have the state enterprises and we have the statutory corporations like WASA and TNTech and HDC. Chagaramas Development is another statutory corporation. And one of the big questions going on for the last 40 years, and I preface the 40 years by going back to 1978, which would take us up to 2018. It's 42 years really. One of the big questions is, who actually controls these public bodies? Who actually controls them? Who actually gives the orders? Is it the board of directors that has its sole and exclusive responsibility to set the strategy and the policy and what they're going to do and what they're not going to do? Or does that come from the cabinet? Does the cabinet tell them what to do? And the board of directors are just there to make it happen? That is really the big question. That so many court cases and so many commissions of inquiry, a huge part of the PIACO commission inquiry was about that, which was in with Clinton Bernard, the late Clinton Bernard. A huge part of the off inquiry was about that. I think off must have spent about 10 whole days with different witnesses daily and this one and Caller Hart and all kind of people discussing this question. To what extent could you really hold the board of Unicut, which is a state enterprise, accountable? Is there a law? And in fact, one of the off recommendations, it might have been number 23 or something, he actually says that Trinidad and Tobago, he was calling on his state, needs to make a decision on this. Is it that the politicians have the right to give a binding instruction to a state enterprise? Or is it just something that they mention? Now, in the case of state enterprises, in my view, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, this is something I've been reading about and thinking about, and I've been on quite a number of boards, and I think I behave responsibly in those positions. In my view, Section 99, subsection 1 of the Companies Act makes it clear that the sole responsibility for those things is the boards. And correspondingly, the board's sole responsibility is the company. So there's a sort of a mating of these two halves, that's how it's supposed to work. Now, that is what the law says. But the Jamaican writer Marlon James says that culture eats strategy. One of his really pithy three-word sentences, culture eats strategy. And what Marlon is saying there is that you can have all of this written down as an intention or an objective, but if the culture is otherwise, that is what will happen. And in Trinidad and Tobago, the culture, and it does not matter whether one is green or one is yellow or one is PNM or one is UNC, those are really, as far as this point is concerned, those are quite irrelevant. The culture in the country seems to be one that if you are a state body and I am a politician, and I won an election, and I put you there. I put you there to do what I want. It's really very simple. That is the culture. Now, this point that I am warming to is close to the center of this whole discussion of ours. Because the politician and the political class, and indeed the class of followers, the group of us who are followers, actually believe that if you elect somebody and they win the election, and they have agencies there that are supposed to do things, they're supposed to do what it is the politicians said they were going to do. That is the social compact or the social contract in a neat kind of form. So there's not supposed to be any interruption between the two. This is important because with relation to state enterprises, it's never been settled. It has never been settled whether, in fact, a company has to follow cabinet instructions. And by settled, I'm aware that case law has settled it. I'm aware the case law settled it. I know, Kamala, I know you were there, Mrs. Rambasad, De Silva, and I'm aware the case law has settled. I'm aware of the cases. I say settled, going back to Marlon James, culture beats strategy. Culturally, we have not settled that. The notion of a board of independent professionals of merit and integrity working only for the interest of the company, which is in law. Yes? That is in law. That notion is not culturally dispersed as yet. So I don't think we've settled it in terms of the cultural conversation. People still believe that the people who own the company have the right to tell the people running the company what to do. Okay? And the question of the board having its own overriding responsibility has not really taken root. We're still at the level of schoolboys and schoolgirls where the board is widely believed to be waiting on instructions and waiting on Miss to say what and waiting on Sir to say what to do and so on. And in fact, that's not the correct position at all. Now, the statutory bodies is where it gets interesting. The statutory bodies, and some people don't know this, the statutory bodies actually have written into their statutes that they have to take instructions from the minister. In the case of HGC, I think it's section 13 of the HGC Act, Act number 24 of 2015 or of 2005. It's actually written in there that the minister can, in other words, the minister has a choice, the minister can issue general or specific directions to the board of HGC, which the HGC shall, mandatory, the HGC shall implement. And that sort of phrase could be repeated across all of these statutory bodies, WASA, HGC, CDA, it's there in all of them. So in fact, statutory bodies are creatures created for a purpose, and I suppose for the ultimately tremendously important functions like water, lights, housing, and so on, that they will have the obligation to follow a ministerial instruction. State enterprises are about a more woolly thing. Now, the procurement law will require that each of these bodies that is transacting public money, the public bodies, has to have a chief procurement officer. I know that Mr. Munilal's office has been carrying on a tremendous amount of workshops and training to get people acclimatized to what all of that means and to make sure that people who are properly qualified and sensitized are appointed into those offices. Because those offices need to be staffed by a biological person. And let's talk about that. The procurement law is a big leap in a different direction. Let's talk about that. When we see TV or cable or news from overseas, the jurisdictions to which we aspire, United States, Canada, England, France, those sorts of places, pre-COVID, of course. When we see those things, we sometimes see stories where a big bank is caught in some breach of some license or some law, and they have to pay a huge fine, 800 and something million pounds, or something millions of US. And we smile to ourselves and say, well, that is, at least people in Wall Street are working. People in the City of London are working. But in fact, the fact that it keeps on happening over and over again tells me that it's not really working. Companies provide for that. they make provisions for it anyway, that they manage their funds. The actual penalties, although they sound huge to us out here, are really a mere fraction, a tiny fraction of the money the company is making. And ultimately, no person pays the penalty. No person. You very, very seldom have anybody going to prison. Very, very seldom have anybody losing their professional accreditation. It just doesn't happen like that. So one of the things we decided to try to do with this procurement law was to put in place a system that pierced the corporate veil. Because what we're seeing there in terms of what happens in England and America when financial companies are penalized and caught in breaches is that the corporate veil is being used to protect the individuals who did the scheming. So the joint stock company is one of the great inventions of capitalism. The notion that there's this thing called a company and we sign these bits of paper. And although it's six of us doing this business together, there's a seventh person in the room, which is the company. And that person is in fact separate from us. We all work for the company. We created the company, but we work for the company. And we are telling the company what to do. But in fact, if anything goes wrong, the company is the one who holds the license to do this or that, and the company will pay the fine. That's how the governance and regulation system works overseas. And that's why it keeps happening over and over, because none of the individuals is held responsible. And that division, that artificial partition between the people who form the company and who run the company and the company itself, that partition in corporate governance and in accounting and in law, and so it's called the corporate veil. And we decided to do something to pierce the corporate veil. And to pierce the corporate veil, what you need to do is to make a biological person responsible, which is what the Trinidad and Tobago law does. A biological, actual human being has to be appointed chief procurement officer for every public body that is transacting public money. An actual person with a date of birth, a first name, a last name, they have to have an actual office in the place and really be working there. And that is the person who approves the contract or awards the contract to supply or to build or whatever. And if anything goes wrong and breaches occur under the act, that is the person who goes to prison. Because in fact, all of the penalties under the procurement law are custodial. There are no penalties where you could just write a check and carry on as usual. So we have situations at the moment in the country where we have agencies like the HDC, which is the Housing Development Corporation, agencies like UDCOT Urban Development, which raised hundreds of millions of dollars from issuing bonds. And those bonds are issued. They became basically, by selling bonds, they became what is called an issuer. When you become an issuer, you have to register with the Trinidad and Tobago Securities and Exchange Commission, so you become a registrant. You're registrant as an issuer. And they have been found on multiple times to be breached of the SEC laws, because the SEC laws requires issuers to publish accounts, audited accounts in a particular timetable. And they've been found in breach many times. And the penalty is $400,000 this time and $300,000 that time and so on and so on. And the same director sits on the board. The company is carrying on as usual. And when you hear ministers speak about those agencies, there's a sense of pride. I mean, Mr. Manning used to say UDCOT was the best performing state enterprise and so on. There's a sense of pride on agencies that are in breach of the law and have to pay penalties for breaking the law and have signed agreements, what they call them settlement agreements, that yes, we broke the law. This new procurement law is going to take a new approach to those things, because there will actually be an individual in the company who had to approve those contracts. And if that individual is found to have broken the law, that individual will go to prison, which was an attempt, just to put the thing in context, which was an attempt to break the chain of responsibility or the chain of irresponsibility coming down from the cabinet to a line minister, maybe to a permanent secretary, to a chairman, to tell a CEO to do this or to give this person a contract and don't give that person a contract. To in fact have a system of impartial professional assessment of proposals so the public interest could be best represented at all times. So that is another one of the changes that we try to get in there. The last thing I wanted to mention, which I touched on in last night's discussion with you colleagues, because we had a sort of a warm-up yesterday with Kamala and myself and Claire. And the last thing I wanted to mention was the whole question of time, you know? One of the distinctive things of things that occurred during the regime of Anan Ram Logan, who was the Attorney General in the previous government of the People's Partnership, one of the distinctive things on this front, there were a number of distinctive things, but on this front, Ram Logan actually brought lawsuits against the board of directors of three legal challenges of three large state enterprises. One was UTT, University of Trinidad and Tobago. One was ETEC, Evolving Technologies and Enterprises. And the third one was Petrotrin. Now, it seems obvious to me that Mr. Ram Logan bought those lawsuits as part of a political agenda. I mean, he's a politician, so politicians have political agendas. So what? And the political agenda was that the late Mr. Malcolm Jones was one of Patrick Manning's, the late Patrick Manning's powerful allies as a technocrat. So if he could find a lawsuit that could embarrass or stymie Malcolm Jones, which is what the Petrotrin lawsuit may have been about, he could do that. And of course, Professor Ken Julian was also a strong ally, a stalwart of Mr. Manning's and a national stalwart for that matter. And Ken Julian was the chairman of UTT and ETEC. So in fact, there was an attempt to bring three lawsuits under Section 99, subsection 1 of the Companies Act. And what's interesting, let's make a pause here. What's interesting is that I checked with about four or five senior counsel who do corporate work. I checked with about six or eight of the senior juniors who do corporate work, well-respected senior juniors. And nobody can remember any other lawsuits on 99-1. So we have a piece of law that's 25 years old. And the piece, the clause in it that I regard as the center, 99-1, which is on what is the responsibility of a board of directors? What are their proper duties? And 99-1 specifies what those are. There have only been three attempts to challenge it legally, all emanating from the same individual's pen, Anan Ram Logan, who was AG at the time. The Petrotrin matter, they were able to get that when Dr. Rowley and his team returned to government in September of 2015. They were able to get a legal opinion from that British QC. I don't know if he's still a QC, Vincent Nelson. And Vincent Nelson actually ruled to say that the case didn't have a sure chance of success. And cutting a long story short, they didn't proceed with any case against Malcolm Jones. On UTT, I think the person who was the main witness just in the closing months of the People's Partnership, he changed his testimony. So they had to let go of that case. And on ETEC, the case went the distance. But what's interesting is that the ETEC case went a different distance on what I would call a preliminary point, but a point that is very fascinating for this discussion and important for this discussion. Because the case the government brought against the ETEC board, which was Professor Ken Julian and Wendy Fitzwilliam and some other people like that, the case that was brought against them and the details of the case don't matter. I'm not going to spend time on that. Was that the board did not discharge its responsibilities properly to oversee a particular major transaction they were getting involved in, okay? And the board said they did. And the case was brought. And the first line of defense the board took was to say that, in fact, you're out of time because there's a four-year limitation rule for civil lawsuits. You're out of time. Because a lawsuit under 99-1 is a civil lawsuit under the Companies Act. And Ram Logan responded by saying, well, it's different. If that limitation act, that four-year rule, applies when things are on all fours, but what if the company that's been put in court, the board that's been put in court, is a politically appointed board. What if the company in question is a company of such high importance that only people of the highest caliber of political connection will be in that board? What if, in fact, the whole situation is one that no matter what they do in that company, the political administration is not ever going to investigate or prosecute or take any serious action against a board of that caliber in a company of that importance? And what if we really have to wait until a different political administration is elected to investigate what went on in there? And the question he put to the court was, in all of those circumstances, which is what he was saying, that is what this is, when do you start the clock running for 4 years? Do you bookishly start the clock running when the offense was committed? Or do you allow the clock to start when there's a new dispensation that is ready, able, and willing to look at things that the past dispensation wasn't ready, willing, and able to look at? And the High Court, the Appeal Court, and the Privy Council in London supported the Ram Logan submissions. So in fact, and as far as I'm concerned, again, I'm not a lawyer, other people will talk in this morning's seminar. As far as I'm concerned, that ETEC case is a matter of tremendous importance for board directors in this country, of politically appointed boards. Because what is actually being spelled out, and the directors, Julian and them, were well represented, Douglas Mendez, and so they had a high-class team, okay? After vigorous, erudite argument, what is actually being spelled out is that your period of responsibility could well stretch beyond the four-year limitation period that so many of us assume is a kind of immutable benchmark. So they won the case in the Privy Council. By they, I mean the state, but it's a bit of a twisted victory, what they used to call a Pyrrhic victory. So the state win the case in the Privy Council. But at the time that they won it, PNM was in office. So the victory of the state against the Ken Julian board of ETEC is recorded in the Privy Council. I've written about it on AfroRaymond.net. But in fact, the case went no further, okay? Because I would have been surprised if the current administration, which is a PNM administration, would have taken those steps to actually prosecute the case now that that barrier had been removed. It didn't go any further. But that is not to offer any comfort. Huh? The fact is that the four-year boundary has now been expanded by this long-term litigation to be, in fact, the clock starting at the change of a political administration. So people who think that they have cover for what they're doing, in light of the procurement law and in light of the ETEC litigation, think again. I'm going to pause here for now, Kamla and Nigel. I'm not sure how long I'm probably going, about an hour now. I will pause here for now.
Thank you very much, Afra. That was very, very interesting. What I will do is go straight to the procurement regulator, Mr. Lalchan,
yes,
and let him, and then we'll save, and then we'll go to Claire. And then we will take questions. So
yeah,
keep your questions and let's...
Yes.
I have a few questions already. So,
good.
Mr. Lalchan?
Yeah.
Munilal, you can unmute your mic. You're still on mute. Right.
All right. How was that?
Good.
We hear you.
All right. Thank you very much, Nigel, and good morning to all the participants. There's very little I want to say coming off from what Afra would have said, because I think he covered some significant points there. But in addition to what he is saying, and when you look at some of the requirements under the Central Tenders Board Act, and I know Nigel would have touched on it, in terms of these special purpose companies under section, I believe it's 20 of the Central Tenders Board Act, That is those clauses under Section 20 in the CTB Act is no longer included in the new procurement legislation. And that is significant because in the discussion, as we were going through with the various stakeholders, one of the requests that we got was to make a recommendation to bring back in that particular section under the new act. And we said absolutely not, because that was one of the reasons why this new act was brought into force. So that is not one of the things that we are proposing that will happen. The other issue that we found out while going through the various pieces of legislation that would have set up the number of different statutory boards and, for example, the regional health authorities and so on, there were specific recommendations in those pieces of legislation that mandated, for example, subcommittees of the board that we call tender subcommittees of the board. One of those organizations actually sought legal advice in terms of whether or not the new act supersedes what is written in their constitutional document. And they were told quite clearly by the CPC, Chief Parliamentary Council, that in fact, those pieces of legislation were impliedly repealed, and the various organizations should take the necessary steps to have it expressly repealed. That in itself would tell you that the role of the board and those subcommittees of the board in terms of how you award the tenders and their participation in that is no longer relevant. So whichever organization have these pieces of little remnants there, you need to take the necessary step to get it expressly repealed. We have gone through all the various legislation that set up these various entities and identify the areas that will be in conflict with the Act, and we'll be doing a paper to the Attorney General in terms of those various pieces of legislation. And the third point I want to raise is, I know most people want to find out, so where are we in terms of the full proclamation of the Act? Well, the Minister of Finance is on record as saying the regulations and the amendments to the Act would have been presented to Parliament if there were no, all things being equal. Well, all things are not equal right now. But just to let the participants know, we did meet, the Cabinet did meet with on the amendment to the Act and also the recommended regulations, and those were passed through the Cabinet and went to the LRC, which is a subcommittee of Cabinet. We did meet with LRC last week, Monday, to start the process of going through line by line and what is required now in terms of the changes to the Act and also the regulations. And we had set up a detailed meeting, an all-day session for last Wednesday. Unfortunately, that could not have come off because of other pressing matters with the LRC. So we are waiting to reschedule. And then the third thing that happened really was that that meeting would have included more than 10 persons, because the participants from the CPC, the Ministry of Finance, my office, Attorney General's office would have exceeded about 20. So that put a different spin on it. So as soon as we are ready, we are also looking at the possibility of doing it online and going through it. So that is going ahead as we speak. We're just waiting for the Attorney General to say ready to go again. So those are my opening comments, and I'm sure there are a number of questions that will crop up as we go along, and I'll be happy to take them.
Thank you very much. Claire, over to you, and unmute your mic.
Good morning, everyone. Nigel, the panelist, our participants. And it's amazing that COVID has been able to bring us all out from 8 o'clock this morning, looking at our computers and our tablets. Never thought that I would have seen this day. But technology is here, and I think that we are happy to embrace it. thank you very much, Kamla, for making sure that this session happens. Also, Afra, Nathan, and Nigel. I think that I would wanted to look at the changing role of the board, specifically as we have a lot of the directors on. So let me see if I can share my screen. All right, because I think everyone is listening and they are very much wanting to hear what is going to be there. Just give me 1 second. Let me see if I can. How do I do this?
The share button is just at the bottom of your screen.
Bottom of my right. Great. Perfect. Yeah. Thank you, Kamla. Sure. Share screen. And let me make sure that I have the right one up. All right. Okay. Right. Are you seeing my screen?
Not as yet.
Okay. And the show. All right,
now you need to switch to the right document.
The right document.
Yeah, because we've seen your Zoom
screen share while the other participant is sharing. Apparently there's somebody else.
No, nobody else is sharing.
No. What you need to do, Claire, is click on your PowerPoint.
Yeah, right. Make your PowerPoint.
I did have it up just now, but it was not showing. Okay, let me see what's going on here. My PowerPoint. All right. And okay. Am I in? Yes, sir. Okay, every time I see that.
Put your PowerPoint in presentation mode.
No, I think Mr. Lal Chan is sharing his screen.
Oh, yes. That's okay.
Stop sharing. Mr. Lal Chan, stop sharing your screen and then. Claire would be able to share his because I try it now, Claire.
All right, thank you.
No problems.
Okay. Let me go back in and go into my share screen. And let's see if it will work this time. All right, are you seeing my screen? Lal Chan, are you still sharing? You may need to stop sharing.
No, he's okay. Not sharing. We're not seeing anybody's screen right now.
All right. Well, okay.
Talk us through it.
Yes, I'll do that. It's a shame that I'm not seeing through. All right. The main changes that you're going to be seeing to the board is that the role of the board is going to change from a decision maker within that procurement process to a policy maker. Because basically what it is that will happen here is, whereas the tenders board, the board tenders committee and the board will make decision as to who will be the final successful bidder. And the contract will be awarded to, you will find that no longer happening. So that will be a major change for the boards. The participative involvement of the board and the directors, and that will no longer be. What you will have here is 100% oversight. So you're seeing now the controls moving from the back end, where it is that the directors would be the one to make that change, to make the decision, and more placing emphasis on how they go about selecting the successful contractor or the successful vendor. You are no longer going to be seeing that. I think I would like to really see everybody, and let me get back to my screen. Sorry about that, because I'm definitely not. Okay, right.
Claire, when we tested it yesterday, it had worked really well. So let's just double check. Is your PowerPoint open on your desktop?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so look and click on the share button now, just underneath your screen, and see if it comes up.
All right. If it doesn't come up, then I'll just have to leave it alone.
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. So share. Mm-hmm. All right. Have you seen anything?
No, unfortunately. No.
All right. Well, I'll have to give up on that one. Yes, it's a shame. I'll try it a little later again. Yes. So at this point in time. All right.
Okay. It may be that you are not using the same device. Is your presentation on, are you using your laptop for the Zoom now?
Yes, I am.
Right. And your PowerPoint is on the laptop?
Yes, it is. Okay. But for whatever reason, it is technology, I think, is taking its challenge on me this morning. So I think
we have to get used to the technology. But talk us through, and then we can.
Yes, I will do that. Yes. Okay. So it's very important for boards and all boards, not only boards of state-owned organization. You're looking at those governing bodies over the same ministries and various agencies, statutory agencies, etc. And also any organization where public monies are being spent. So I think it is very important now for those who are spending public monies, as AFRA clearly defined, those boards will also be impacted, because it means to say that once you are involved with public money, it means that you must be in compliance with the legislation, must be in compliance with the act. So the board will no longer be in that decision making, which is the most important part here. The board will be more involved in setting the policies, and those policies must be aligned with the legislation sanctioned by the regulator and enforced by the board. So it's letting go of control of that procurement process once it is that you sanction that procurement policy. And you are handing over to the chief procurement officer. I know that will be a major change for the directors, because they have been very much involved in making decision. And that is what's not going to happen. The decision is going to be made upfront with your procurement strategy plan, your budget, how much cost is going to be allocated to any planned procurement. How are you going to ensure that there's funding for that spend, and how you are going to monitor that spend, how you are going to ensure that corporate compliance. And I think that would be the most significant change to the board. Over to you, Nigel.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't know if I agree with you, but that's why we are here to have conversations. So let me start the conversation by first summarizing what AFRA said, and I made some notes while you were talking. For me, one of the most significant points you made this morning was the whole question of how do you define public property, and you advise about real and personal. But I also wrote down here tangible and intangible. For me, the other very important thing is that as a board, we must be looking at, and I put in, the long-term best interests of the company. And there we also have a debate of how do you define company. Mm-hmm. Is it the shareholder? What about the workforce? What about customers? What about other stakeholders? So again, we need to be mindful. The other thing you said is And one of the questions I have is, are you saying that private companies must adopt procurement legislation for their own procurement processes, or only when they are dealing with public entities, including state entities? So don't answer yet. I'm going to think. Then the whole question, either Lalchan or Afra, the whole question of the procurement register. Is it that a state entity should not invite a firm to tender if they are not on the register? Is that correct? The chief procurement officer, is this a full-time and permanent position? And then to Claire's point about the role of the board, the question is here, the board, the interests of the company lie with the board. The board is not a day-to-day decision maker, but the board has to put in place policies, processes, to ensure that the management of the company to which it oversees, that management is not only acting in the best interest of the company, but it has the processes and procedures and controls, etc., in place to ensure that the company as an entity is marching in the right direction. So I'll leave it there and I'll turn it over to Afra to answer some of those questions, and then we, and then Lalchal and then Claire, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Okay.
Afra. You're on mute. You muted yourself.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Right. Just to respond to some of the points you said so far, the first person I would come to in terms of just an immediate rejoinder is you, Claire. You are speaking in a form of words. I know you come from the profession of accounting. You're speaking in a form of words which needs to be really scrutinized. You're speaking about people who are spending public money. And I want to make it clear that the intention is to deal with any transaction in public money. And in fact, the first definition is not just spending. Even if you are making money to the state, like FCB, okay, a profitable state enterprise, you in the act. NGC making money, they in the act too. It's not just to do with those who receive a subvention. So we need to be 150% clear on this. That in fact, anyone who is transacting in public money is subject to this act.
Yeah.
Because that opens up the point about the financial market that I was making in my introduction, yeah?
Yes. Because under the act, it says public money means money that is received or receivable by a public body.
Correct. Absolutely.
Raised by an instrument from which it can be reasonably inferred.
Yes.
That the state accepts ultimate liability in case of default.
Yes. And in fact, Claire, let me rejoin there with you again. Because in fact, we just need to be really to stake out this ground. Eh? And in fact, this section in the preamble, before the public money section, defines what is a public body. And the public bodies are listed. And the last one, tantalizingly, and I'll read it aloud here. A body corporate or unincorporated, in other words, a joint venture entity in relation to any function, project, scheme, or arrangement which involves the use by it of public money. So it's not even saying fully funded by public money. It could be 25% funded by public money. Let's look at it again. A body corporate or incorporated in relation to a function, project, scheme, or arrangement involving the use of by it public money. Okay?
Yes.
So even above it's belt and braces, those things are all included. So that's the first point I wanted to say. Nigel, in relation to your two points, as usual, very fascinating. The tangible and intangible points, I included intangible in terms of my thinking. I included intangible when I spoke about are you all seeing me?
Yes.
Good. I included intangible when I spoke about every other type of property that's not real estate.
You did.
So I was talking about, just to make an example, and when Mr. Louis Lee Singh had a company called Citadel, which is the radio station. And Mr. Louis Leasing is a well-known businessman. And Mr. Louis Leasing sold Citadel, the One Caribbean Media, years ago, 12, 13, 14 years ago, whatever it was. The licenses alone for the radio station with that stream of income was $53 million. It was reported to be $53 million.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't sell the buildings. He didn't sell any property in Travido or nothing. He just sold OCM, the licenses for those radio stations mm-hmm. that he had built into a success. So it's a lot of money we're talking about. If we're talking about TV stations, and for example, all of these sort of corruption allegations that went around about our former Minister of National Security, Jack Warner, a lot of those allegations were centered on TV rights. The right to broadcast this series of football matches and into that market and so on and so on. So these intangible things, as Nigel is saying, could be of tremendous importance, mm-hmm. not only culturally to a country in terms of what people see and on what terms, but also financially, which tends to be our focus within these procurement discussions in terms of the flows of money that gets spread around on these things, whether it's cricket, Stanford cricket or whatever, or football or so on. Now, the question you asked, two questions, Nigel, about the responsibilities of private companies, and I found them really interesting. The first question you asked was whether I was saying that a private company should have the same standards as a public company in procurement. And no, I wasn't saying that. Private companies need to have standards in procurement. It's my observation as a private sector person that a lot of untoward, improper, corrupt practices take place within procurement, within the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
That has nothing to do with this political party or that political party or this minister or that minister. Companies in business with each other can do each other things that are unfair and that are corrupt. And in fact, to be quite frank, the one wouldn't like the other one to know what they were really doing and so on and so on. Those of us who are in the private sector know it happens. So companies have to protect themselves, their shareholders, their reputations by putting procedures in place that they could answer questions. Well, okay, this is how we gave this person this contract. Mm-hmm. This is why we decided to use that person and so on. You need to be able to satisfy yourself about that.
Yeah.
The other point you're asking, Nigel, now just as a touchstone with this point about the private sector standard of procurement, let me just go back to Lord Sharman, which is one of the things that we took a lot of comfort from. Lord Sharman wrote a report in 2001 for the House of Lords in England, and the name of that report, it's a seminal report, is called Holding to Account. Nigel and Claire would know about it. And Holding to Account was an attempt by Sharman, I think Blair was in government, to sort of map out what was the responsibility for, how was it going to be managed and how was it going to be accounted for in relation to public money? Because there were tremendous concerns in the UK about the private finance initiative, the roles of quangos, quasi-autonomous NGOs, the role of NGOs, the role of ministries, defense spending, allegations of overseas corruption. There were tremendous public concern over these issues. So they put Sharman to look at it. And one of the important findings in Sharman's work was seminal to us in doing this work. Huh? One of the important things in Sharman was his finding that public money must be accounted for and managed to a higher standard than private money.
Yes, that's correct.
I think that's accepted in the professional universe in terms of these matters. And Sharman is really, he makes the case very compellingly because the public money is raised by force, coercion, and we call taxation, and you don't have a choice. You have to pay it, they accrue it, and therefore how they spend it has to be to a higher standard. The other thing I wanted to say, Nigel, you made another point that was tantalizing. You asked the question about whether a state entity would be required only to select people from the list maintained by the procurement regulator. And I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. I would leave that in the hands of my esteemed colleague, Mr. Monilal Lal Chan.
That's a good cue for me to get here. After all, let me just throw something on the table here.
Go on.
We speak about real and personal property,
yes,
tangible and intangible.
Mm-hmm.
What's the definition of real property? It speaks to land.
Mm-hmm.
Land is also defined as everything above and below.
Yes.
What about our petroleum products?
Mineral rights.
Our mineral rights.
Mm-hmm.
how are we dealing with the disposal of our mineral rights, the oil and gas, and I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to come back to that. Yeah. I will come back to that for sure.
Let me.
We've been asked one in an intervention in that regard already, and we have given our opinion.
I will say something about that just now.
But let me go on to speak to another thing. Yes. Under Section 61, Nigel, it speaks to who shall be responsible. And it says that 61.2, the purpose of the act, a public body shall have a procurement officer. Every public body, by definition, shall have a procurement officer.
Yes.
It's difficult to see because of the importance of that role, a person put in that role, you have them as a temporary.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the regional corporation have clerical temporary workers doing multi-million dollars procurement.
Yes.
That has to stop.
That's wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cannot ask ministries now to take over the responsibility of what was before under the Central Tenders Board with all the expertise and put an AO 1, 2, 3, or 4 to do procurement. That is not going to work because they are going to be handling multi-million dollar contracts.
Yeah.
The second point is going to be a permanent position, but somebody who is well qualified and experienced to deal with procurement.
Mm-hmm.
Then the whole issue of the register under Section 13Q, the responsibility of the office is to prepare and maintain a database of pre-qualified contractors and suppliers.
That's correct. Yeah.
Prepare and maintain a list of pre-qualified mediators, arbitrators, and experts for the purpose of alternate dispute resolution on this app. So in other words, yeah, if you really want to give enforcement to the ineligibility listing, and especially where we have these silo behaviors, in order to make sure that everybody is aware of who is qualified or who is not qualified to deal with public bodies, you need to have one central database.
Yes.
When you so-called blacklist somebody from that, that information will be shared across the board. The other thing that is important is that you will have one method of dealing with pre-qualification, because you have as many as you have the 245 public bodies doing pre-qualification, everybody have their own standards.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be now standardized into with, of course, you have safeguards for people who will be dealing with like the oil and gas sector. They will be so certified in the construction sector. They must have their HSSP systems and policies and so on in place. So in the legal profession is also going to be specific in medical profession for like specialist doctors dealing with the regional health authorities. And so they all have to be pre-qualified in some form or fashion. We have already had meetings with the Law Association and agreed in terms of how lawyers will be pre-qualified on the database. So all those things will be done. And if you do not have somebody who is on the pre-qualified list of contractors and you want to do business with them, the recommendation is that you do a parallel system. While you're doing your request for proposal, you have them pre-qualified at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that way, you will get them on the database, and other companies will have sight of that. A very important question here that comes up is, what about the cost of doing the pre-qualification? The office will not be doing the pre-qualification. We will be setting up the database. In fact, the database is being tested this week. Anybody who wants to come in, they come in onto the database and put in all the information. And then through a workflow process, the contractor or supplier has to state which public body they have dealt with or intend to deal with. That information is transferred to that public body to do a due diligence in terms of the pre-qualification. So the public body has an input and a major part to assist in the pre-qualification. So those are some of the things that we have put in place. So the database is up and running. We are testing it. We had sent out advertisement to all the prospective companies or individuals who want to be pre-registered. And unfortunately, we have to put a hold on it because we can't meet in groups of 100 as we was intending to do. But what we are doing is exactly what Kamala did in this case. We are going to do it online and have people come into the database through an online system, and we'll do the presentation online also. Mm-hmm. I hope that answers your question, Nigel.
Just one clarification. Craig, before I go to you, I just want to check something with Lalshan. So if I have an employee who is working, he is the chief procurement officer of the company, does it mean that that is all he can do, or he can do other stuff?
Absolutely not, because it
is a full-time position. Right. But it doesn't mean that that must be the only thing the person is working on. Am I correct?
In some cases, like the larger organization, you take a Heritage or NGC, that person is a full-time, and that is all that person will be doing. Mm-hmm. Because the enormity of what will be required. In some agencies, for example, some of the sporting organization that falls under the Section D of the public money definition, you may be required to do other things in addition to, but what you are required to do, those other things should not be a breakdown in internal controls, where that person is actually doing the procurement, approving the invoice, and et cetera, et cetera. So there must be clear lines of segregation of duties, but it doesn't stop somebody from fulfilling another role, but it should not be a conflict.
Okay, good. Claire, you wanted to say something?
Yes, and 2 points. You make mention of tangible and intangible, and whether that in disposal of state lands, whether it is that we are really looking at tangible, intangible. The Act was amended in 2016, 20th day of May 2016. And it says, notwithstanding the State State Lands Act and any other written law to the contrary, the minister, and this means the Minister of Finance, may make regulations in respect of the disposal of state lands, real property owned by the government, real property owned by state-controlled enterprises, and real property owned by a statutory body, responsibility for which is assigned to a minister of government. And then it says, regulations made under this section shall be subject to negative resolution of parliament. So as we move forward, we are going to get a lot more clarification around, and a lot more clarity around this disposal of state lands and the real meaning of real property. And I do believe that it is not only land alone, it's not only real estate. It ought to be also shares, maybe in subsidiary companies, within state company joint ventures, investments, etc. So I believe as we move forward, the Minister of Finance, who will be the one to draft those regulations, will be stipulating the amount of control that the boards will have over disposal of those types of assets, right? So it means that the board at this point in time would be more looking at the disposal of inventories and furniture and fittings, motor vehicles, etc., and whatnot. But for the time being, all organizations will have to await the regulations that will be coming out for the disposal of state lands.
Let me just add something there.
Yes, go ahead, man.
We have asked, because of a potential conflict under Section 13O, where it says that the official act on and in name of and behalf of the state to dispose of real property owned by the government in such a manner as the government may consider appropriate and desirable. This was actually taken word for word from the Central Tenders Board Act. And we have the opinion, and we have asked the government to take that out, because we should not be responsible for acting on behalf of the state. We have also asked for the office to write those policies and procedures and to advise the government in terms of the regulations. In the same way that we write regulations for procurement, we should go the same route once that is taken out on Section 13O. We should be part of that process in writing those regulations for the government, for the minister to take to parliament for affirmative resolution.
Right, thanks. And another point here is that the list of qualified contractors, vendors, et cetera, your pre-qualified listing.
Yes. Yes.
The legislation is very clear that the board responsible or the company remains responsible for its due diligence.
That's right.
In preparing that procurement, the pre-qualification listing for your procurement, again, the company must have very stringent policies and procedures as to how they are going to select those contractors.
And that falls under the pre-selection criteria under section, same section 29, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Yes.
So I have one other question, and it has to do with process and making it, as I like to say, easy and enjoyable. So I am a foreign consultant or a foreign contractor, and I have a key skill that may not be available locally. What kind of processes and procedures are you putting in place to ensure that the qualification is an efficient and very effective process, so that we don't slow down the procurement process while making sure that the best interest of the company is served?
All right, so right now, what, Claire, I'll allow you just now, let me just.
Okay.
Right now, I am absolutely sure that the various organizations take the necessary step to do their due diligence before they engage the services of a supplier contractor. We are in Trinidad a little dot on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And if we try to pre-qualify some of those contractors and suppliers under Section 29, some of them will just turn their back and say, well, we could do without your business. All That's right. the reality of the situation. So what we are saying is that the same sort of a due diligence that you do right now in assimilating the information to make sure that those contractors and suppliers pass the asset test, you take that same information and put it on the database. So we are asking the public bodies to actually do that population for us if the contractors and suppliers do not want to do it. That way we will have the information. You would have gone through the due diligence, because we know, especially for example, in the medical fraternity, some of the medical equipment that we buy, if we decide that we're going to say, well, you're not buying the equipment unless you pre-qualify, I'll tell you something, we'll never get those equipment. So we have to be realistic as to how we do deal with it and put in the information that you will normally go through your due diligence in making sure, because the last thing we want, and now you know what is happening in the international arena. Before you do business with some of these big suppliers and contractors, you have to pay down the full amount before they even decide that they're going to ship those pieces of equipment for you. And you don't want these companies to walk away with your funds. So you will have to do some of that due diligence. So I hope that answers the question nicely.
Yes.
Thank you. Claire?
Yes. And as Lachan says, the due diligence that must be undertaken has to be undertaken within an early enough period that you don't end up with this emergency procurement as we all know it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Emergency procurement will really and truly have to be like a COVID issue, a pandemic issue, something that has come upon us that we really and truly did not know of. Your risk management is supposed to have already kicked in to know exactly what would be the challenges for your organization where procurement is concerned. Your procurement plan, which is supposed to be done months before the start of your fiscal year and which is required by the legislation. So that already is supposed to tell you that you will need such a consultant, yes, and maybe those, and all your research under that due diligence has to already start, because like, for instance, some of the things that are being asked for under that due diligence, and that is within the Act. The suppliers and contractors must have the legal capacity to enter into the procurement contract. So you have to get that done before.
Mm-hmm.
They are not insolvent, in receivership, bankrupt, or being wound up. All of that information you have to get long before.
Mm-hmm.
Have not, and their directors or officers have not been convicted of any criminal offense, have fulfilled their obligations to pay all required taxes and contributions in Trinidad and Tobago. And you have some other items there. So it means that at no point in time should an organization just suddenly determine that they need this type of service, be it professional service or goods, works, in the ordinary sense. They must be able to be a lot more proactive. The legislation here is forcing you to be very proactive. A lot of things must be done up front. And I think if it is, we understand it from that perspective. As we said before, the controls are up front. not in the back end, they're in the front end. So a lot of things have to be put in place now to allow you to procure seamlessly within a timely, in a timely manner, and also meeting the specific needs of your organization. As Lalchan says, certain industries may require certain different standards or different procedures, but at the same time, you must understand those unique requirements of the organization and make sure that they are in your policies, that and those policies are sanctioned by the regulator. So you have all of that done in the front end.
Okay. Afra, you're on mute. Afra, you're on mute.
Sorry, are we okay now?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think Richard Young has a question.
Okay, let me just make this quick thing. It's beautiful that you're making that point clear about the vetting before going forward. Okay, and the requirement of a board to have proper procedures of vetting, because ironically, that was the subject of the ETEC litigation.
Yeah.
So you said, in fact, what you had now, going back to you, Nigel, about this gray species, they weren't putting up a building, so it wasn't works. It wasn't for the supply of goods. Yes? It was an expenditure of public money, which I think they described it as an investment in a company called Bamboo Technology, something, something. And it went wrong, which was not the subject of this discussion. But the point is that subsequent examination criticized the degree to which they did due diligence. Mm-hmm. Okay? That has not been litigated, I don't want to say anymore. But it's the very same thing you're talking about, Claire. Because the Ken Julian-led board was making a type of investment, I forget whether it's $5 million or $10 million US, but they were making a type of an investment. It wasn't a building, and it wasn't to supply motor cars or car tires, but it was a transaction in public money that landed us in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So that requirement to check is really important. I'll leave it there for now.
Let's open it up to questions from the rest of the Yes, Rich, who is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I am. But let's defer to someone first, though.
Yeah. Anybody else have a question? Just unmute and ask your question.
So far, I think it was just Mr. Young who had his hand up. So possibly we could.
Okay. So, I'm still not clear, and Monira knows that I've had this issue about fiduciary responsibility of a board member and the procurement process being delegated to a procurement officer who may not necessarily be full-time. And at the same time, there's a process of how the procurement is done. I understand that. But I strongly believe that as a board member, that before any contract of a certain size, I'm talking materiality now, mm-hmm. is awarded, mm-hmm. that the board must have a final tick. Otherwise, you're not going to get people, I'm talking about the state boards, you're not going to get any board people wanting to then serve. You could put in all the controls, and I agree, the process, everything, the independence, referring to Monila's register, if I could call it that, Monila, and all those sort of things. But at the end of the day, I think as board members, we must recognize we have a fiduciary responsibility. And can't say, well, you know, the process was there. And, you know, clear to your point about the procurement plan, yes, I agree, you must have a procurement plan in advance. It's required annually. But the business is fast changing. If I found somebody who could value my properties faster than Afra, because I only met them at a conference last week, then I have to use them because they're going to offer cheaper than Afra, right? And I wouldn't say better, but faster. So, you know, it's a fast, all I'm saying is, yes, we do as best as we can, get it onto the register, make sure in your procurement planning you expect, because in the business that I am in, which is the TTIFC and outsourcing and fintech, things are moving so fast. If I wanted a fintech consultant, right? It's because Omar has gone and attended a seminar and networked and met fintech players, go to Beach Tech or whatever it is. And only, you know, and then seeing the vibrancy of this tech, this business and coming back and saying, listen, we need a guy who could talk to us about, I'm just using it loosely, electronic national ID to transact. Mm-hmm. And this, these people have only just come on the scene because they're new, they're what they call, you know, startups.
Right.
So we have to have, and I guess it's really more appeal and not disagreeing, Juclair, that Munira, we have to have that mechanism where the onboarding or the registering of it has to be very fast. And we have to be careful because you don't want to start asking people information about themselves and then they feel they hold you to ransom because they kind of work out you really need them and then they charge you a premium like they charge for hand sanitizers. You know, so it's a very, funnily, a very fluid word, a very fluid thing. But
it's like all a agree.
Yeah, exactly.
For me, you have your delegation of authority, and based on the level of spend, the approval is goes to a higher and higher level, and at some point in time, that level is the board, whether it's a tick or an approval. For me, that I don't think this changes anything.
It does.
Not for me. If I am on a board, I am going to make sure that that is how I run the board. Legislation or no legislation. I am taking on the responsibility because of my head and my reputation on the line. Okay, so that's one. The other one is that in the case of, in your case, Richard, where you're dealing with emerging technologies and stuff, There is a tension, there is a conflict even between moving fast and making sure that you are managing your risk. And I think you have to do both.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of scammers coming at you as well. And for me, it's important in that case that you have expertise advising you so that you can ask the right questions and not be caught with the next best thing when it may not actually be the best thing. So it's a good tension. And even in the private sector, you would have to do this, but in the public sector, when you're dealing with public monies, you have to be even more cautious. That for me, I mean, and it may slow you down a bit, but if you have the right people in place and you have the right processes in place, you should be able to speed up. But that's the tension that we have to deal with, in my humble opinion.
Let me see if I could add some clarity. So I know Richard and I would have had this discussion, and Nigel and I would have had this discussion quite recently also, in terms of the role of the board and the role of the audit committee of the board. The role of the audit committee now becomes even more important in terms of looking after the interests of the board in terms of these procurement activities, and they should be checking into it on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we have suggested is that for these high risk, high value contracts, that is probably in the public domain, everybody's looking into it, they want to know what's happening. So the procurement, main procurement officer makes a recommendation to the CEO. The CEO says, yes, I'm okay with it. You have gone through all the different steps. It is in keeping with the handbooks and guidelines that is approved by the board. And the ones that you want to see, we say that the CEO should send it to the board for a no objection. Say, hey, we are about to award this. This is the process we followed. We're sending it to you because we know it's a high profile. It's not for you to approve it. If you do not agree and you think something is not right with it, you have to put your concerns in writing and send a copy of that to the regulator. Because then there is a disagreement between the CEO and so on, and we don't want that conflict between the board and the CEO, where the board has a particular mandate from higher up, and I'm being clear now.
Yes.
You have a mandate from higher up, and you have to see a certain outcome. And you would have followed due process in terms of the ticking all the boxes at the procurement level and the CEO level, and then only to have it overturned at the highest level. You have to have very good reasons. And that could be the subject of an investigation by the office.
Right.
Yeah. And here is where, if you're looking at most organizations right now, the large organizations, they already have the approving structure in place. From the CEO, we have a financial limit. And then it can go into what you may call a management procurement and tenders committee, which most organizations already have established. So there's a collective decision making there and not only leaving it to one person. Right? But even more so is that oversight that is coming from that board. Apart from the audit committee, and as I do agree with Lalchand that the audit committee's role has to be expanded to make sure that they look at especially the procurement risk and how well those risks are being managed within the organization, and also compliance with the legal requirements, right? But the agenda for the board procurement and tenders committee, and also the agenda for the board, is that continuous oversight, that direct oversight over the procurement process, not making decision. It is not making decision.
That's so, right.
Right. So you must be able to have on your agenda that company procurement policies. Are we in alignment or not? What is happening there? Procurement risk assessment must be on the agenda. Procurement strategy and the budget must be there. The tender invitation and awards. So there's a continuous feeding of information into that board so that they can know if it is management is not following the process right, or there's an issue that the chief procurement officer is saying that maybe there's bid rigging, or maybe suspects something that is happening. Something else is going on. And mm-hmm. he wants to bring that to the attention of the board. So because he may not have that authority over other persons within the organization. Although, again, the authority and the level of responsibility needs to be looked at. I think Lalchand made that point up front. You must have a professional person as your chief procurement officer. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oversight over the contract variations and claims, and that's by and against the contractors. Yeah, the contractor complaints from and against, maybe complaints that's coming from within the organization, because all of those complaints, etc., can lead into that. Remember the listing of Lalchand, you spoke of it, the blacklisted contractors.
Ineligibility.
Right, we'll have to come through your process within the organization. Contractor variations and claims, you have to go through all of that.
Yes.
The pre-qualifications and registration of contractors and vendors, all of that you have to have oversight over. Your evaluation and deregistration of contractors and vendors, because it should not be just for the for management or the chief procurement officer to decide that, okay, we want to delist. The board must be satisfied that, yes, all the criteria are being met to delist. Yes, the criteria that is being exercised even for the evaluation of the contractors, all of that the board has to be able to sanction and make sure that those are being implemented. Then of course the disposal of assets. So there must be that continuous oversight. So the board is not going to abdicate its responsibility for due diligence and care and place all of that within the hands of the chief procurement officer. That is not what's going to happen. The board remains responsible and accountable under the legislation, the same procurement legislation. And so although the legislation is pointing towards the chief procurement officer is going to be the first one that is deemed to be guilty, right? The one who's going to be charged. But really and truly, it rolls up to what is the part that the board played in setting the policies and ensuring that those policies are inculcated, disseminated throughout the organization. There's proper recruitment of the procurement unit and proper resourcing of that unit. So is the board going to be culpable for failing to do so? So all of those new challenges and new requirements that must be met by the board within that procurement legislation, I think all board members must start understanding what it is that they have to put in place and what it is that they have to oversee on a continuous basis.
Okay, Afra, you had a point?
Okay, two small points I wanted to make here, because mm-hmm. I think the discussion is mm-hmm. tremendous. We had a tremendous discussion. And you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Good. But I think it's now time, in my view, colleagues would respond as they see fit. I think it's now time to bring the rubber into contact with the road. So we've been discussing things that are governance, a level of principles and procedures and policy and good practice and so on. And it's been a beautiful discussion. Let's put the rubber in contact with the road. The first thing I want to say, because we've been discussing the responsibilities of the board, that has been the center of this morning's discussion.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I want to say, and I know it's part of your guidelines and procedures, Munilala, the OPR, and I know it is also part of the first stage in the procurement cycle, is the needs assessment.
Yeah.
A board of a state agency or a public body that is entering into an arrangement, which is what we have to call the ETEC thing, we have to call that an arrangement, or a contract for the provision of goods, works, or services. Standards is another arrangement. An agency entering into an arrangement, a public body, must have conducted a need assessment. Mm-hmm. So we need to put that for participants who are beyond the seminar table here.
Yeah.
That is number one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can't be talking about a contract and whether Tom gets a contract or Bobby gets the contract if you didn't do a needs assessment. What is your needs assessment? It has to be rigorous. It has to be defensible. It has to be evidence-based. And Richard, I take your point about fast-changing fields and so on. But I stick to my point that there needs to be a needs assessment. What are we doing and why are we doing it? That would avoid so much mischief.
Mm-hmm.
The second point I wish to make is that we also need to go to the facts of what's happening now in the competitive and tendering universe and step back from our fascinating discussion and look at what's happening now. For the first 2 months of the year, there was a skirmish and a battle on the question of government-to-government arrangements and public-private partnerships. And I want to say that the shape of things to come in terms of what's on the table, what is before us, and this is not about this administration or the one before Mr. Patrick Manning, the shape of things to come for the last 15 years, what is emerging in front of us is a future in which more and more of the bigger and bigger contracts are being conducted by an approach that is non-competitive. There is no tendering. Let's talk about it. Labrador Dockyard, there's no tendering in the government. Labrador Dockyard can fall square in 7.2 of the procurement law as a disposal of public property, which is exempted under 7.2. And Mr. Lalchan wouldn't have an oversight, and he could conduct the whole thing under the rubric of a disposal of public property by way of a lease and a joint venture thing to decide. And we need to be mindful of these things. Maybe the joint venture would fall under Mr. Lalchan's microscope. But we need to be mindful of these things. The Chinese housing contract the HEC was doing, being conducted under the HCIP, which is a form of the public-private partnership, the Housing Construction Investment Program. That program being conducted was for 5,000 homes. They were going to crowd out all of the private competitive medium-sized and small-sized contractors. And the whole Housing Construction Investment Program, HCIP, which is probably 80% of what HEC is building for the next X amount of years in terms of a medium-term strategy, that entire thing is being conducted in a non-competitive approach. The projects aren't put up for tender. People are invited to qualify, so they qualify by submitting their accounts and their financial profiles and so on. And then deals are struck under a PPP rubric. So we need to be mindful, first of all, the responsibility for the needs assessment as point number one. You cannot move beyond point number one without a satisfactory needs assessment or a business case. And secondly, the whole approach the state has embarked upon now for its major affairs is a public-private partnership, government-to-government approach. So I think we need to be aware of that. And I'd like the colleagues for us to speak to that, if you may.
A good point for you. Are government-to-government contracts excluded?
Well, I just saw a note from Richard. Let me just read section 7, which is the of it. It says that the Act applies to public bodies and public-private partnership arrangements.
Yes.
The extent that this Act conflicts with an obligation of the state under existing out of the following,
Yes.
A treaty or other form of agreement to which Trinidad and Tobago is a party with one or more states or entity within a state. An agreement entered into by the government of Trinidad and Tobago with an international financial institution.
Mm-hmm.
An agreement for technical or other cooperation between the government of Trinidad and Tobago and the government of a foreign state. The requirements of the treaty or agreement shall prevail except that the procurement of goods, works, or services shall be governed by this act. The government has a particular issue and says that we should remove that from this act.
Yes.
And we as the office and all the civil society groups have said, no, that should remain.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to remove that based on what Afra has just said, if you want to remove that from the act, it's better you don't have a procurement act.
Yes.
Just take the act and tear it up and that's it. Because that goes to the root of what is taking place right now and has taken place over the years.
Yes.
And therefore we cannot as a country give up our sovereign rights because you said that you get preferential interest rates and these government-to-government relationships have special covenants and terms and so on. Who is to say we cannot get a better term if we go out for competitive bidding? Remove that from Section 7.2. And you know what you have done? You have given up your right for competitive bidding. Nobody says that the final decision may eventually go to the same company.
Right.
You have to invite your local contractors. Who is going to lose out on this? Yeah. If it's changed, it's the local contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to continue to be a drain on the exchequer.
Yeah.
So we are saying, as an office, we do not agree with the recommendation to change that at all. In fact, if you go to the Hansard record, you see the amount of debate that this would have gone through to arrive at this particular clause. To change it now after you have agreed to it with the requisite majority and so on, you had an opportunity. And this was actually agreed to by all the parties when this was placed on the legislation. And this was a make or break decision when it was actually up for the discussion. So go and change it now, I think it's gonna create more problems than anything else.
Right, yeah. And may I make a statement here too?
Go ahead.
The act speaks to two areas, bid rigging and conflict of interest. And oftentimes we are not seeing those issues coming to play when it is that, especially even some of those treaties that Lajan was just speaking of, right? Once it is that you are not going through the procurement process as it ought to be under the legislation, the risk that you are having here is that bid rigging and that conflict of interest, where it is that decisions are being made to award multi-million dollar, billions of dollars in contracts that will be awarded with bid rigging and lack of conflict of and lack of diligence around that conflict of interest. The act defines bid rigging as it means collusion between persons for the purpose of manipulating the proceedings. And with a definition like that, that becomes very, very wide. And I know the lawyers will use that definition. And a lot of cases can fall within that bid rigging definition. So I think the boards must be aware of the policies and also the legislation around those two areas.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Kamla, how are we doing for time? I think we are about at the end of
sending the question.
Of the session. Am I correct? You're on mute, Kamla. Kamla, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. Yes. Okay, so yes, no, the session is intended to end at 10:30. So
right,
we do have about 10 minutes again. I think there was a contribution from one of the participants. I'm not sure if it's a comment that they wanted us to read. Okay, let me see if I identify it from. Okay, so I don't know who this person is because it's just JGS1159. So she says, good morning, or he, good morning, everyone. Thank you. This legislation has to be groundbreaking internationally. from a governance perspective, lesson one in corporate governance has always been that the board is the policymaker and the provider of oversight. However, directors have happily strayed into doing as opposed to steering and monitoring. So as directors, we are now being forced to fully embrace what it means to steer, monitor, and oversee. What policies, processes, and procedures do we as directors need to ensure are in place to be effective in our role? So, and that person went on with one question, please, and that is, the presenter spoke to state and statutory bodies. Does the central bank fall under the Procurement Act?
Rajan?
I take care.
As far as I'm concerned, they use public money.
Yes, good.
There's very little to, because just to add to that, the bodies that are defined under the act takes from right up the ladder, the president, the office of the president, parliament, the judiciary from Chief Justice come down. Just those are just the first three. And I'll stop there because that tells you the level that this legislation deals with. Yeah. From the president of the country to the chief justice of the country, the commissioner of police, you name it, and they fall under the act.
Okay, good. So the answer is yes.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, it's properly defined. Yes.
Yes.
Public okay, monies.
Good. Any other questions? Don't hesitate to.
Hi, morning, Robbie from Ghana. Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm wonderful.
Good.
I have a lot of things that I could say, but I just want to seek two clarification. Initially, Afra made mention that if you go on the finance website, you will Ministry of Finance website, you will see that the CTB, if I have it correct, is a yes. part of the Ministry of Finance.
That's correct.
Is that part of?
It's not part of. Or it falls under the purview of the Ministry of Finance.
That's yes. right, it's a division of the Ministry of Finance, yeah.
Okay. Yes. Are you, do you think it is appropriate or should the CTB be a body completely removed from under the purview of the Ministry of Finance? In this day and age where transparency and accountability and all these things are taken into consideration, we must consider the segregation of duties.
Yes.
The Ministry of Finance is typically responsible for all payment.
Yeah.
And having oversight of the CTB, they can have some form of influence on the CTB. In Guyana, we have the same thing here, and it's part of my crusade, so that this could be the what we call the National Procurement Tender Administration Board. It should be completely away from the Ministry of Finance. Maybe it has some reporting mechanism to the parliament or something whereby the appointment of these board members are done by parliament and its selects committee rather than by the Ministry of Finance and picking, because most times we find these things are political appointments rather than people with competence and expertise. So if you, in your knowledge and experience, if you think at some point in time the CTB should be removed from the purview of the Ministry of Finance. And my second question, I probably missed this in all the deliberation. What is your highest level of approval authority? Does the cabinet in Guyana, we have the cabinet, has a part to play? We yes. are very, I think we are somewhat advance in terms of the legislation, but in Guyana, based on what I'm hearing from you, but in terms of our compliance to the legislation. For example, we are supposed to have a public procurement commission, which I think is similar to your Office of Procurement Regulators.
Yes.
And it says that when the public procurement commission is constituted, the cabinet no longer have oversight.
Yes.
We had the Public Procurement Commission constituted after 3 years ago, after a 13 years hiatus. Now, even though that it is, now what we have found is that the Public Procurement Commission has observed some of the responsibilities of a bid process committee, which is an arm of the Procurement Commission. So the commission of itself absorb that function of the bid protest committee. So there is no bid protest committee, which they become the judge, the jury, and the adjudicator. And they also absorb some of the functions of the public procurement commission, the National Procurement and Administration Board. And also the cabinet remains the function of approving contract of a certain value.
Yes.
So while we have the legislation, we don't have the compliance.
Yeah.
So having said all of that, I'm just trying to find out what is your approval authority? Does cabinet has a role in all of this? Thank you.
Lalchan, you want to ask, you want to respond?
As far as I'm aware, before you award a contract or you go out for a request for proposal, all those should be, so the government has their budget approved. That budget have all the different agencies would have submitted all their requests for capital expenditure, et cetera, et cetera. So it should fall under a ministry or a special purpose company or wherever it is that those budgets come from. I am not seeing anywhere in the legislation where it has any remnants of the cabinet being responsible for approving any one of those contracts and so on. And that plan has to be published 6 weeks after the reading of the national budget. So we are all aware of all the contracts coming down through the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
There is no room in the legislation for cabinet being responsible for the approval of those contracts.
And the other question was the Central Tenders Board. Should it be outside of the purview of the Ministry of Finance?
Well, just to add to the previous point that we made, that you asked, Nigel, what we did, we had a meeting with a present Minister of Government and a previous Minister of Government to find out exactly how the cabinet now get involved in these contracts and so on. And it was interesting that both parties said the same thing, that with the new legislation and so on, it ought not to happen. Central Tenders Board is not going to be a problem for Trinidad now, because under the new act, the Central Tenders Board is no longer in existence. So that the Central Tenders Board Act is repealed. Mm-hmm. And Section 28 of the Tobago House of Assembly that references the Central Tenders Board Act, also that part of the Section 28 of the House of Assembly Act is also repealed. So we don't have a problem with Central Tenders Board and reporting requirements, though the Central Tenders Board is no longer in existence when the act is repealed.
That's good to hear. I have one comment. You said that after the national budget has passed, then you have to prepare your procurement plan. It is my humble opinion, a procurement
before your budget,
a ministry, because the procurement plan, it what feeds into that ministry's budget.
And
all the requisite approvals, then when it comes, so let's, well, the ministry, we all know the ministries and the different agency cuts and so forth. So when it goes to Parliament and Parliament approves, then they approve based on the procurement plan, then you just have to modify your procurement plan based on what is approved.
Yeah.
I have the same challenges back home here where it will be too much before I get into it here, but...
Rabbi, you're correct.
Yeah, you're quite correct.
Because your corporate budget has to have all of those procurement plans coming into it. And then your procurement budget goes into that national budget as coming from the ministries and the state organizations per se. So you are correct on that one. But the Central Tenders Board as it is right now, because our procurement act has not been proclaimed as yet. But then in fact, there is a Central Tenders Board Act that tries to ensure the separation or the independence of that Central Tenders Board. So yes, you may have the issue of somebody having to appoint the board members. Yes, you will always have somebody, be it the president or be it the Minister of Finance or Parliament. But where the Minister of Finance is, he is just that overseeing ministry, because all organizations will fall within the realm of a ministry for oversight.
Yeah.
Not for that decision making, because the Central Tenders Board Act will state how a decision is made, and the decision is made really and truly by that Central Tenders Board for the award.
In my humble opinion, politicians are politicians. And I believe that the appointment of boards, especially the national procurement and tender, should not be a function of the Ministry of Finance. Like in our Guyana, we have the National Procurement Tender Administration Board, which the Ministry of Finance approve. Then there is the Public Procurement Commission, where the government and the opposition more or less have the power in that. And that has to go to the parliament for the parliament select committee to vet and do all their due diligence. And parliament approved that public procurement commission.
Perhaps all politicians.
Sorry?
All politicians. So yeah. That we expect that when you take up public office, you remove your politician hat and then you look at what is it that you are responsible for, in what interest, in whose interest you're acting. And if in acting in the interest of the nation, then we really and truly should not be with the politicians. So we expect that the separation be there. We expect that all of our public officials have that separation and recognize it and act upon it. That separation of politician from public official. And from that perspective, you will always find that a public, there will be public offices that will have oversight even over the procurement regulator. So you'll always have that linkage going into those public bodies.
Certainly, certainly. I'm not disputing that, but I'm just saying in terms of removing the political aspect of this whole.
Yes, this whole I totally agree with you.
And maybe perhaps in us doing so in selection of a board, you should say, well, naturally the government will want a representative. The opposition should be offered a representative. Civil society organization, maybe the ACCA or some accounting body, maybe the bar association. So it should have people, the requirements, legislation requirements should state who comprise the board and not just the minister decides who he wants to put. Because those are some of the things I have been advocating for at our end, and I will continue to do so.
Right.
The legislation speaks to the persons who are supposed to be on that board. So, Lajan, you can speak to that?
Yes, Section 12 actually tells us, Section 13, 2 of the Act says that we shall not be subject to the direction or control of any other person, but shall be accountable to Parliament. In fact, our report was directed to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. The board, all the members of the board are appointed by the President, and our term of office will outlive, even if you have a change of government, we remain in the positions. And there are specific qualification and experience of every member of the 11 members. There are specific qualification of experience. So some may be from civil society groups, some may be accountants, some may be engineers, some have procurement specialists and so on. And we are fully constituted and we are totally independent. In fact, we don't report to any line minister.
Good. Okay. Well, it's now 10:27. I think we have had a very lively and engaging discussion, and I hope that our participants are now much more educated about the procurement legislation and the role of governance and the role of the boards in that process. And I want to thank Afra and Lalchan and Claire for their input today. I mean, we're going to continue this conversation. I'm a big fan of the Washington Post and its byline, which says that democracy dies in darkness. And this is about shining light. This is about making sure that what you do, you would be happy for it to be on the front page of the local newspapers, or in this case, all the social media stuff. But the point is that we want people to be making decisions and being comfortable that when they make those decisions are made truly in the long-term best interest of the organizations that they serve. So I will shut up now. And I again thank you all very much. And I will send it back to Kamla. Kamla, you're on mute, by the way. So unmute before you start to speak. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Nigel. Before we leave, I just want to invite everyone, if you will join us tomorrow, we have a webinar where we would be looking at the changes that are currently taking place with respect to COVID-19. So it's the governance response to COVID-19. Among our panelists tomorrow, we have the executive director from the Barbados International Business Association, as well as we expect the president of the Jamaica Chamber of Commerce to be joining us, along with other representatives here from Trinidad and Tobago. So this is something that as soon as we get off of this, we know we are going to recognize is going to bring about a lot of our attention. So thank you all very much. I truly appreciate this. And I look forward to you guys joining us. It's free to our members tomorrow from 10 a.m., a one-hour session. Thank you all.
Thank you all. Take good care.
All the best, colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. Bye.